on the bed. First, wash and dry any tin cans. We need to bury anything of value.
But we haven't done anything wrong, Ade. Germans are cultured people. Hitler has them under some kind of spell.
Matka's mother had been pure German, her father half Polish. Even woken from sleep, she was beautiful. Soft but not fragile, a natural blonde.
Papa grabbed her by the arm.
Your cultured people want us gone so they can move in, don't you see?
Papa went about the apartment gathering our most valuable possessions in a metal box with a hinged lid. Matka's nursing certificate, their marriage license, a small ruby ring from Matka's family, and an envelope of family pictures.
Get the bag of millet. We're burying that too.
Matka pulled the canvas bag from under the sink.
They'll probably do a house-by-house search for Polish soldiers in hiding, Papa said, keeping his voice low. They've broadcast new rules. Poland no longer exists as a country. No Polish will be spoken. All schools will close. There will be curfews. A pink pass is required to violate them, and we are not allowed weapons or ski boots or any food over our ration limit. Secretly possessing these things is punishable by...
Again, Papa looked at me and stopped speaking.
They'll probably just take whatever they want.
Papa pulled his old silver revolver from the dresser drawer. Matka stepped back, away from it.
Bury that, Adi, she said, her eyes wide.
We may need it, Papa said.
Matka turned away from him.
Nothing good comes of a gun.
Papa hesitated and then placed the gun in the box.
Bury your Girl Guide's uniform, Kasia. The Nazis are targeting scouts. They shot a pack of Boy Scouts in Gdansk.
A chill went through me. I knew not to argue with Papa and placed my prized possessions in tin cans. The wool scarf Pietrik once wore that still smelled like him. The new red corduroy shift dress Matka sewed for me. My Girl Guide's uniform shirt and neckerchief. And the picture of Nadia and me riding a cow.
Matka wrapped one of her sets of Kolinsky sable hair paintbrushes, which had been her mother's, and added them to a can.
Papa melted wax on the seams of the tin cans.
That night, only stars lit our back garden, a patch of dirt surrounded by a few planks of wood, held up only by the weeds around them.
Papa stepped on the rusty shovel blade to push it into the ground. It cut through hard soil as if it were cake, and he dug a deep hole, like a baby's fresh grave. We were almost done, but even in near darkness, I could tell Matka had kept her engagement ring on her finger, the one her mother had passed on to her when Papa was too poor to buy her one. The ring was like an exquisite flower, with a big center diamond surrounded with deep blue sapphire petals. It glittered like a nervous firefly as Matka's hand moved in the darkness.
The diamond is cushion cut, from the 1700s when they cut stones to react to candlelight,
Matka would say when people admired it.
React it did. Shimmering. Almost alive.
What about your ring? Papa asked.
The firefly flew behind her back, protecting itself.
Not that, Matka said.
As children, when crossing the road, Zuzanna and I had always fought over who got to hold Matka's hand that wore that ring. The pretty hand.
Haven't we buried enough, I said. We'll be caught out here.
Standing there arguing in the dark would only attract attention.
Suit yourself, Halina, Papa said.
He flung shovelfuls of dirt into the hole to cover our treasures. I pushed earth into the hole with my hands to make things go faster, and Papa tamped it down smooth. He then counted his steps back to the building so he'd remember where we buried our treasure. 12 steps to the door. Zuzanna finally came home with terrible tales of the doctors and nurses working all night to save the wounded. Word was many were still alive, trapped under rubble. We lived in fear of hearing the sound of Germans at our front door,
our ears to the radio in the kitchen, hoping for the best news, but hearing the worst. Poland defended herself, sustaining great losses, but in the end could not match Germany's modern armored divisions and air power. I woke Sunday, September 17th, to Matka telling Papa what she'd heard on the radio. The Russians had also attacked Poland from the east. Was there no end to the countries attacking us? I found my parents in the kitchen peering out the front window. It was a crisp fall morning, a light breeze blowing in through Matka's curtains. As I drew closer to the window, I saw Jewish men in black suits clearing the rubble from in front of our house. Matka wrapped her arms around me, and once the road was cleared, we watched the parade of German soldiers roll in, like new tenants in a boarding house with their mountains of luggage. First came trucks, then soldiers on foot, then more soldiers standing tall and haughty in their tanks. At least Zuzanna did not see this sad sight, for she was already at the hospital that morning. Matka heated water for Papa's tea as he watched it all. I did my best to keep us all quiet as could be. Maybe if we were silent, they would not bother us? To calm myself, I counted the birds crocheted on Matka's curtains. One lark, two swallows, one magpie. Wasn't the magpie a sign of imminent death? The rumble of a truck grew louder. I breathed deep to quell the panic inside me. What was coming?
Out! Out! A man shouted.
The terrible clatter of hobnail boots on cobblestones. There were lots of them.
Stay away from the window, Kasia, Papa said, stepping back himself. He said it in such an offhand way, I knew he was scared.
Should we hide? Matka whispered. She turned her ring around and closed her hand so the stones hid in her palm. Papa walked toward the door, and I busied myself with prayer. We heard a good bit of yelling and orders, and soon the truck drove away.
I think they're leaving, I whispered to Matka.
I jumped as a rap came at our door, and then a man's voice.
Open up!
Matka froze in place, and Papa opened the door.
Adalbert Kuznetsk, said an SS man, who strode in all puffed up and pleased with himself.
He was two hands taller than Papa, so tall his hat almost hit the top of the door when he entered. He and his underling were dressed in full Sonderdienst uniform, with the black boots and the hat with a horrible skull emblem with two gaping holes for eyes. As he passed, I smelt clove gum on him. He looked well-fed, too. His chin held so high, I could see the blood through a little piece of white paper stuck on his Adam's apple where he'd cut himself shaving. They even bled Nazi red.
Yes, Papa said, calm as could be. Director of the Postal Center Communications?
Papa nodded. Two more guards grabbed Papa by the arms and pulled him out without even time for him to look back at us. I tried to follow, but the tall one blocked my way with his nightstick. Matka ran to the window, eyes wild. Where are you taking him? Suddenly, I was cold all over. It was getting harder to breathe. Another SS man, skinny and shorter than the first, stepped in with a canvas bread bag across his chest.
Where does your husband keep his work papers? Asked the tall one.
Not here, Matka said. Can't you tell me where they're taking him? Matka stood, fingers locked at her chest, as the skinny one went about the house, opening drawers and stuffing whatever papers we had into his bag.
Shortwave radio?
The tall one said. Matka shook her head. No. My stomach hurt as I watched the skinny guard fling our cabinet doors wide and toss what little food we had into his bag.
All provisions are the property of the Reich, the tall one said. You will be issued ration cards.
Tinned peas, two potatoes, and a sad little cabbage went into the skinny one's bag. Then he grabbed the rolled paper bag that held the last of Matka's coffee. She reached forth. Oh, please, may we keep the coffee? It's all we have.
The tall one turned and looked at Matka for a long second.
Leave it, he said, and his underling tossed it onto the counter.
The men stepped through our three little bedrooms and pulled drawers from bureaus, dumping socks and underclothes on the floor.
Weapons,
said the tall one as the others searched closets.
Any other food?
No, Matka said. I'd never seen her lie before. He stepped closer to her.
You may have heard that withholding that which is due the Reich is punishable by death.
I understand, Matka said. If I could just visit my husband. We followed the men out to the back garden. The yard, fenced on all sides, suddenly seemed smaller with the SS men standing there. It all looked normal. But the ground where we'd buried our things the week before was still beaten quite flat. It was so obvious something was buried there. I counted the guard's steps as he walked into the yard. 5, 6, 7. Could they see my knees shaking? Our chicken, Sheena, moved closer to our buried treasure spot, scratching near it, looking for bugs. My God, the shovel was there, leaning against the back of the house, dirt still clinging to the blade. Would they take us to Lublin Castle or just shoot us in the yard and leave us for Papa to find?
Do you think I'm stupid?
The tall guard said, walking toward the spot. 8, 9. My respiration shut off. Of course not, Matka said.
Get the shovel, said the tall guard to his underling. You really thought you'd get away with this?
No. Please, Matka said. She held on to the St. Mary medal she wore on a chain around her neck. I am from Osnabrück, actually. You know it? The taller guard took the shovel.
Of course I know it. Who hasn't been to the Christmas market there? Have you registered as Volksdeutsche?
Volksdeutsche was the German term for ethnic Germans living in countries other than Germany. The Nazis pressured Polish citizens with German heritage like Matka to register as Volksdeutsche. Once registered, they got extra food, better jobs, and property confiscated from Jews and non-German Poles. Matka would never accept Volksdeutsche status, since that showed allegiance to Germany. But this put her at risk, because she was going against the Reich. No, but I am mostly German. My father was only part Polish. Sheena scratched the soil around the smooth spot and pecked something there.
If you were German, you'd not be breaking rules, would you? Withholding what is due the Reich?
Matka touched his arm. It is hard dealing with all of this. Can you not understand? Imagine your own family.
My own family would have handed what they had to the Reich.
The SS man took the shovel and continued toward the spot. 10, 11. I'm so terribly sorry, Matka said, following him. The man ignored Matka and took one more step. 12. How far would he dig before he hit the box? Please, give us another chance, Matka said. The rules are so new. The guard turned, leaned on the shovel, and gave Matka a thorough looking over. He smiled, and I could see his teeth clearly, like little chewing gum tablets. He leaned closer to her and lowered his voice.
Maybe you know the rule about curfew?
Yes, Matka said, a tiny crease between her brows. She shifted in her shoes.
That is a rule you can break.
The SS man took Matka's medal between his thumb and forefinger and rubbed it, watching her the whole time. One needs a pink pass to violate curfew, Matka said.
I have them here in my pocket.
He dropped the medal and put his hand over his heart.
I don't understand, Matka said.
I think you do.
Are you saying you'll let this go if I come visit you?
If that is what you heard.
The Germans I know are cultured people. I can't imagine you would ask a mother of two to do that.
The man cocked his head to one side, bit his lip, and picked up the shovel.
I am sorry you feel that way.
Wait, Matka said. The man lifted the shovel into the air above his head. My God, no! Matka cried. She reached for his arm, but it was too late. Once the shovel was in the air, there was no stopping it.
Chapter 3. Hertha. 1939. At midnight, Father and I walked 6 blocks from our basement apartment to a nicer part of Düsseldorf, to the white stone townhomes where servants swept the streets and pinched back geraniums in window boxes. It was late September, but the air was warm still. Führer weather, they called it, since it permitted Hitler success in his campaigns. It had certainly worked with Poland. I climbed the steps to the double doors, inset with filigreed, white-painted ironwork over frosted glass. I pressed the silver button. Was Katz even home? There was a faint glow behind the frosted glass, but the gas lanterns to either side of the door were not lit. Father waited on the street in the darkness, arms hugging his midsection. I was 25 that year when Father's symptoms grew bad enough for him to seek out his favorite old Jewish treater of the sick, a man named Katz. We were not allowed to call Jews doctors. The term treaters of the sick was preferred. Nor were Aryans allowed to frequent non-Aryan doctors, but my father seldom followed the rules. The doorbell chimed somewhere deep in the house. I'd never set foot in a Jew's house before, and was in no hurry to do so. But Father insisted I accompany him. I wanted to spend as little time there as possible. A brighter light appeared behind the frosted glass, and a dark shape moved toward me. The door to my right opened a crack to reveal a former medical school classmate of mine, one of the many Jewish students no longer welcome at the university. He was fully dressed, tucking his shirt into his pants. "What do you want this time of night?" he said. Behind him, Katz descended the stairs, steps soundless on thick carpet. The train of his midnight blue dressing gown fanned out behind him. He hesitated, hunched like a crone, eyes wide. Expecting the Gestapo? Father hobbled up the front steps and stood next to me. "Excuse me, Herr Doktor," he said, one hand on the door jamb. "I am sorry to bother you, but the pain is unbearable." Once Katz recognized Father, he smiled and ushered us in. As we passed, the former medical student looked at me with narrowed eyes. Katz led us into his panel study, 3 times the size of our apartment, the walls lined with shelves of leather-bound books. It had a spiral staircase which led up to the second level, to a railed balcony lined with more bookshelves. Katz turned a knob on the wall, and the crystal chandelier above us, hung with 1,000 icicle pendants, came to life. Katz eased Father down into a chair that looked like a king's throne. I ran the tips of my fingers along the chair's arm, across the red damask woven with threads of gold, smooth and cool. "It's no bother at all," Katz said. "I was just reading. My bag, please, and a glass of water for Herr Oberhäuser," he said over his shoulder to the former medical student. The young man pressed his lips together in a hard line and left the room. "How long has the pain been like this?" Katz asked. I'd never known many Jews, but had read many accounts of them in schoolbooks and in Der Stürmer, grasping and controlling, cornering the market on law and medical jobs. But Katz seemed almost happy to see Father. Strange, since we'd intruded on him at such an hour. This was a man happy in his work. "Since dinner," Father said, hugging his belly. I was almost done with medical school at the time and could have counseled my father, but he insisted on seeing Katz. I studied the room as Katz examined him. The black-and-white marble fireplace, the grand piano. The books on the shelves looked oiled and dusted, each one worth more than I made in a year, trimming roasts for Uncle Heinz part-time at his butcher shop. There was no doubt a well-used volume of Freud among them. Several lamps stood about the room, throwing down pools of light even when no one was using them. If only Mutti could have seen that wastefulness. Katz fingered the sides of Father's neck. As he turned Father's hand to take his pulse, the light caught a fat letter K monogrammed in silver thread on Katz's dressing gown sleeve. "Working at the Horschaft factory may be causing this," he said to Father. "I would stop working there immediately." Father winced, his skin sallow. "But we can't live without that job." "Well, at least work in a ventilated area." The former medical student returned with a crystal glass of water and set it on the table next to us. Could he not bring himself to hand it to Father? Little did he know Father was on his side. If he hadn't been so sick, Father would have hidden a whole tram car of those people in our back bedroom. Katz shook a pill from a bottle into Father's hand and then smiled. "No charge." Was that how they did it? Got you hooked, then charged more later? Our schoolbooks outlined the various strategies Jews used to undermine hard-working Germans. They were taking over the medical world. My professor said they were stingy with their research results and barely shared findings outside their own circles. While Father took his pill, I browsed the titles on the bookshelf. Clinical Surgery, Stages in Embryo Development in Humans and Vertebrates. Whole shelves of green leather tomes with titles such as Atlas of the Outer Eye Diseases and Atlas of Syphilis and Venereal Diseases. "You like to read?" Katz asked. "Hertha graduates soon from medical school," Father said. "On an accelerated track, she's interested in surgery." I excelled in the few surgery classes I was allowed to take, but being a woman, under National Socialism, I was not allowed to specialize in surgery. "Ah, the surgeon," Katz said, smiling. "King of doctors, or at least the surgeons think so." He pulled one of the green books from the shelf. Atlas of General Surgery. "Have you read it?" I said nothing as he pushed the book toward me. It seemed some Jews shared. "Once you learn everything in here, bring it back, and I'll give you another," he said. I did not touch it. What would people say, me taking the book of a Jew?
"You are too generous, Herr Doctor," Father said.
"I insist," Katz said, still holding the book out. It looked heavy, the leather cover soft, embossed in gold. Could I borrow such a thing? I wanted it. Not so much to read it. I had textbooks, ugly and second-hand, other people's notes scratched in their margins, breadcrumbs in their gutters. This book was a beautiful thing. It would be nice to be seen with it, to walk into class and drop it casually on my desk. Mutti would rage at Father for allowing me to take it, but that alone was worth it. I took the book from Katz and turned away.
"She's speechless," Father said, "and a fast reader. She'll return it soon."
It was a useful book, in some ways more detailed than our medical school textbooks. In less than 1 week, I read from Inflammation and Repair of Tissue through Cancer of the Lymphatic System. The text and color plates provided additional insight into my father's condition, epithelioma, sarcoma, radium treatments. Once I made it through the last chapter of Katz's book, Amputations and Prosthesis, and practiced two new surgical knots described there, I walked to the Jew's house to return it, hoping for another. When I arrived, the front doors were wide open, and the SS were carrying cardboard boxes of books, Katz's black medical bag, and a white wicker baby carriage, its wheels spinning in midair to the curb. Someone was plunking out a German folk tune on Katz's piano. I held the book tight to my chest and left for home. Katz would not be coming back for it. Everyone knew of these arrests. Most of the time they happened in the night. It was sad to see someone's possessions taken in such a way, but the Jews had been warned. They knew the Führer's requirements. This was unfortunate, but not new, and it was for the good of Germany. Less than a week later, I spied a new family with five sons and a daughter carrying suitcases and a birdcage into that house. My mother was happy to work in her brother Heinz's meat market across the bridge in Oberkassel, a wealthy part of town, and she had gotten me a job there too. It was a small shop, but Heinz filled every inch with meat. He hung hams and long ribs of pork outside along the front of the store like socks on a clothesline, and displayed whole hogs, spread-eagled, belly slit wide, glistening entrails scooped and saved. At first, I blanched at the sight, but as a medical student interested in surgery, I gradually grew to see beauty in the most unlikely places. The startling ivory of a splayed ribcage, a calf's severed head, peaceful as if asleep, a fringe of lashes black against the damp fur. "I make good use of every part of an animal," Heinz often said. "Everything but the squeal." He boiled pig parts on the stove all day until the windows fogged and the shop somehow smelled both putrid and sweet as only a butcher shop can. As greater numbers of Jews left the city, we became one of the few quality meat shops left, and business improved daily. One afternoon, Heinz passed along news benefiting the customers lined up too deep at the front counter.
"You have to get over there to the Platz, ladies. They are selling everything from the warehouses. I heard Frau Brandt found a sable coat there with a silk lining. Hurry now!"
No one said they were selling items taken from the Jews, but we all knew.
"How awful they took people's things away like that," said Tante Ilse, Heinz's wife, who avoided the shop as much as she could. When she did come, she brought me a jar of her strawberry marmalade, which I'd once complimented. Ilse kept her coat wrapped tight around her even though it was summer, and stayed only 2 minutes. "It's a sin to pick through someone's things as if they're dead." Tante Ilse paid for most of my medical school costs. A kind praying mantis of a woman, tall and gentle with a head too small for her body, she'd been left a great deal of money by her mother and used it sparingly, no matter how Uncle Heinz brayed. Heinz smiled, causing his piggy eyes to disappear into the folds of his fat face.
"Oh, don't worry, Ilse. They probably are dead by now," he said.
The patrons turned away, but I knew he was right. If Ilse was not careful, her own considerable belongings would end up there alongside the Jews. The gold cross around her neck was no protection. Did Ilse know what Heinz did in the refrigerated room? Perhaps, on an instinctual level, the way a calf knows to become restless on slaughter day.
"You shed a tear when the Jew crystal shop closed, Ilse. My own wife, a Jew friend, shopping at the competition. That is loyalty, nicht?
He has those baby hens I like.
Had, Ilsa. It doesn't help my business when this gets around. Soon you'll be on the Prangerliste.
I held my tongue, but I'd already seen Tante Ilsa's name on the Prangerliste, the public list of German women who shopped at Jewish stores, posted about the town, a black stripe running diagonally across it.
You don't see Crystal's wife in here, Heinz said. Thank God! And no more Frau Zartes either. Wants a cabbage but will only pay for a half. Who buys half a cabbage? I cut it, and who buys the other half? No one. That's who.
Why should she buy whole when she needs only half? Ilsa asked.
Mein Gott, she does it on purpose. Can't you see?
Keep your thumb off the scale, or you'll have no customers, Heinz.
Mutti and I left Heinz and Ilsa to bicker and walked along to the sale at the Platz. It was rare Mutti had any time to shop, since she was up at 5:30 each day to do mending before she cleaned houses or worked in the shop. Thanks to the Führer's economic miracle, she was working fewer afternoon hours but still seemed just as tired at day's end. She took my hand as we crossed the street, and I felt her rough skin. I could barely look at her dishpan hands, red and peeling from cleaning toilets and dishes. No amount of lanolin cream could heal them. People gathered in the square to watch as Wehrmacht soldiers threw household items into great piles and displayed finer items on tables. My pulse quickened as I approached the heaps, sorted according to use and gender. Shoes and handbags, crates of costume jewelry, coats and dresses. Not all the finest styles, but with a little hunting, one could find the best labels for next to nothing. That elevated Mutti's mood, and she started a pile for us.
Look, Chanel, I said, holding out a red head. No hats, Mutti said. You want lice? And why cover your hair, your best asset?
I tossed the hat back on the pile, pleased with a compliment. Though my shoulder-length hair was not white blonde, many would have considered it honey gold in the right light. A good thing, since every German girl wanted blonde hair, and the use of peroxide was discouraged. We passed a mound of canvases and framed pictures. A painting of two men embracing lay on top, the canvas spiked through on a spear from a sculpture below.
My God! Jew art! Mutti said. Can't they just hang a calendar on the wall like the rest of us?
On his way home from the pharmacy, Father joined us there by the piles. The creases on his face looked deeper that day. A rough night on the sofa. I lifted a scrapbook from a table and flipped through the pages, past black and white photographs of someone's beach vacation.
This is undignified, Father said. You two call yourselves Christians?
Of course he disapproved. Why had he even stopped to speak with us? I tossed the scrapbook on our pile.
Anton, can you not relax a bit? Mutti said.
I pulled a painting, one of two of grazing cows, out from under a crush of framed canvases. It was well done, perhaps even a masterwork. Traditional German art. Just what the propaganda ministry found suitable, and something every cultured woman should own.
What do you think, Mutti?
Mutti pointed at the cows and laughed.
Oh, it's you, Kleine Kuh.
Kleine Kuh was Mutti's nickname for me, Little Heifer. As a child, she had a brown cow that I reminded her of. I had long ago dealt with not being as dainty and blonde as my mother, but the name still rankled.
Don't call Hertha that, Father said. No girl should be called a cow.
It was good to have Father's support, even if he was a lawbreaker who listened to foreign broadcasts and read every foreign newspaper he could lay hands on. I took the two paintings and set them in our pile. "Where have the owners of all this gone?" I asked, though I had a general idea. "To the Katzet, I suppose," Mutti said. "It's their own fault. They could have stepped aside, gone to England. They don't work. That is the problem."
"Jews have jobs," Father said.
"Yeah, of course. But what jobs? Lawyers? That is not really work. They own the factories, but do they do the work? No. I'd rather do 10 jobs than work for them." Mutti pulled a dressing gown from the pile and held it up. "Would this fit you, Anton?" Father and I didn't have to see the silver K on the sleeve to know who the former owner was.
"No, thank you," he said,
and Mutti walked off, scouting the piles.
"Are you sure, Father?"
I took the dressing gown and held it out to him. "It's a nice one." He took a step back.
"What has happened to you, Hertha? Where's my girl with the tender heart, always first to take up the collection can for the neediest?"
"Katz was a man you could have learned from."
"I haven't changed."
It was obvious he didn't support or even like me much. But did he have to broadcast this?
"Katz was compassionate. A doctor without love is like a mechanic."
"Of course I'm compassionate. Do you know what it's like to be able to change a person's life just with these hands?"
"You'll never be a surgeon with Hitler around."
"Can't you see that? Your generation is so pig-headed."
Much as I hated to admit it, he was right about the surgeon part. As one of a handful of women in my medical school, I'd been lucky to be able to study dermatology, never mind surgery, and had received only basic surgical training.
"We all must sacrifice, but Germany's changing thanks to my generation. Such poverty yours left us with."
"Hitler will be the death of all of us just taking what he wants."
"Quiet, Father," I said. "How dangerous for him to respond in such a way in public. He even told jokes about party leaders. Hitler is our hope. In no time he's gotten rid of the slums, and he must take. Germany can't thrive without room to expand. No one will just give back the land we've lost."
Many parents had grown wary of confronting their children for fear of being denounced by them, but not my father.
"He's killing Germany to feed his own vanity."
"This war will be over within weeks. You'll see," I said.
He turned with a dismissive wave.
"Go straight home and rest before afternoon coffee, Father."
He walked away, barely avoiding a passing tram. Father would need a nap. The cancer was having a party in his body. Could cuts have helped him live? It was no good wasting time with such thoughts. I busied myself searching the piles for medical books. Mutti hurried to me.
"I found rose-scented soap and a toaster."
"Don't you worry about Father, Mutti. He's going to be denounced. I can feel it." Though my parents were both products of German blood and could trace their pure German ancestry back to 1750, my father could not hide his lack of enthusiasm for the party. He still put his traditional striped German flag in our front window next to Mutti's new red party one, though Mutti was always moving his to a side window. No one noticed it in the sea of swastika flags hung outside every building, but it was only a matter of time before someone turned him in.
"Ja, Feind hört mit, Hertha," Mutti said.
"The enemy is listening." She pulled me closer.
"Don't worry about that, kleine Kuh. Focus on work."
"I'm allowed only dermatology." Mutti pressed her fingers into my forearm.
"Stop it. You'll be working with the best and brightest soon. You can go all the way."
"Someone needs to rein Father in." Mutti turned away.
"What will people say if we have these things in our home?" she said, shaking her head at the toaster in her hand.
We paid for the items we'd chosen, the toaster, the scrapbook, the paintings, and a mink stole with the glass-eyed heads still attached, a luxury item Muti was willing to risk life for. The soldiers threw in a doctor's frame diploma Muti said she'd used to display her Aryan blood certificate and some canvas running shoes for me, all for only 10 marks. We seldom had bread to toast, and Muti could not afford to go anywhere she could wear such a mink, but the smile on her face made it all worthwhile. I was happy to have those new running shoes for a sleepaway trip I was chaperoning the next week at Camp Blossom, a camp situated in a pine forest, half a day's train ride north of Düsseldorf. It was run by the Belief and Beauty Society, which was affiliated with the BDM, the Bund Deutscher Mädel, or the League of German Girls, the female wing of the Nazi Party youth movement. The Belief and Beauty Society was for older girls only, to prepare them for domestic life and motherhood. This sleepaway trip was intended to transition the younger ones into the organization, and my job as unit leader was to look after the girls in my cabin. Not an easy job. Unit leaders received day assignments, and I was sent to the craft hut. A blatant mismatch, since I considered painting amateurish watercolors and weaving gimp lanyards a complete waste of time. Plus, my considerable talents lay outside the art world. With my extensive medical training, I should have been running the camp health clinic, but one serves where one is needed. At least the hut looked out over the lake, which reflected the reds and oranges of the trees surrounding it. Pippi, another girl assigned to work the craft hut, joined me there one afternoon. I'd known Pippi since we'd both joined BDM, and though she was a few years younger than I, we were good friends, well on our way to being best friends, something every other girl seemed to have. Pippi and I had done everything in BDM together, earned our badges and leadership cords, taken turns carrying the flag in at meetings. At the camp, we shared meals and even tidied up the work tables and the craft hut together. "Let's hurry," I said. "It's about to rain." Pippi took the scissors from the tables and plunked them into the metal cans around the room. She was terribly slow about it. She nodded out the window. "Look who's waiting." At the edge of the woods, two boys stood, one blonde, one dark-haired, next to a rowboat pulled up on shore, a deep rut in the sand behind it. I recognized them, unit leaders from the adjacent boys' camp, dressed in camp uniform khaki shirts and shorts. They were part of the boat crew. Handsome boys, of course. No camper of low racial value was allowed at any German youth camp, so everyone was attractive, guaranteed to be racially pure. There'd been no need to measure our heads and noses with calipers and craniometers. We'd all submitted pure genetic histories. They fiddled with the boat's oarlocks, taking glances back at the craft hut. "You know what those boys want, Pippi." Pippi checked her face in the mirror above the sink. Next to it, a poster fixed to the wall with tacks read, "Remember you are German. Keep your blood pure."
"So what? I just want to try it. It's fun."
"Fun? We can't finish a relay race here without couples heading for the woods." What fun was a race if no one won? At Camp Blossom, the staff were encouraged to look the other way if Aryan couples paired off. If a pregnancy resulted, the mother was sent to a luxurious SS spa clinic, and the birth of a healthy child was celebrated, no matter if the mother was married. All this focus on children was understandable, of course, since the future of Germany depended on populating our country. But with my sights set on becoming a physician, I could not afford a pregnancy. I slid a pair of scissors from one of the metal cans and secreted them in my shorts pocket. Pippi's eyes widened. "Ever done it yourself?" she asked in a casual voice. It hurts, you know, and no matter what they say, if you have a baby, you'll be sent out of the BDM, shipped off to Wernigerode, the middle of nowhere. Pippi pulled a stack of postcards from her shorts pocket. They featured views of die Mutterhäuser des Lebensborns, a stately chalet. One showed a nurse tending to a ruffled bassinet on a tree-lined terrace under the SS flag. They say it's like being on holiday, the best of everything, meat, real butter. Maybe, but the father will not be involved. Once the child is born, they take it away to be raised by strangers. You throw a wet blanket on everything, Hertha, she said, fanning herself with the cards. Once the boys finished fiddling with the boat, they stood, hands in pockets. I tried to stall, waiting for them to leave, but eventually we had to go. Side by side, Pippi and I started down the path to our cabin. We turned, saw the boys following us, quickening their pace, and Pippi bit her lip into a smile. Hurry, I said, pulling Pippi by the arm. The boys picked up speed, and Pippi and I took off toward the woods. I left the path and crashed through low brush and briars while Pippi, an accomplished sprinter, lagged behind. As I ran, the sting of the scissors' point stabbed my leg. Why did this make me feel so oddly alive? I ran around to the far side of an abandoned cabin next to a rushing stream and crouched on the mossy bank. Catching my breath, I set my scissors down and examined the wound on my thigh. It was a surface wound, but had produced a startling amount of blood. Despite the sound of the rushing water, I heard the boys nab Pippi. "You run so fast," she said, laughing. The three clambered into the cabin, and I brushed away the jealousy I felt. What would it be like to kiss such a good-looking boy? Did I need to tell my supervisor if Pippi succumbed? "What a good kisser you are," I heard Pippi say. I heard the creak of the bedsprings, more giggling from Pippi, and then moans from one boy. Where was the other one? Watching? Pippi put up embarrassingly little resistance, and I heard them breathing hard and loud. How could she?
You can't keep your clothes on, one boy said.
It's so dirty in here, Pippi said. I crouched there motionless, for any move would reveal my position. Pippi seemed to be enjoying it all, but then she had a change of heart.
No, please, she said. I need to get back. It's not fair to get this far. You're hurting me, she cried. Hertha!
Friends help each other, but I'd warned her.
Why hadn't she listened? Her lack of discipline was a weakness.
Help! Pippi cried. Someone, please!
Aiding her would only endanger me, but I couldn't leave her in that situation. I took up the scissors, cold and heavy, and stole to the rotted cabin steps in the almost darkness. The screen door lay on the ground, off its hinges, so the doorway provided a good view. There were many rusted metal beds in there standing on end, and Pippi lay on the only horizontal one. It had collapsed, the mattress ticking stained and torn. One of the boys was lying on top of her, his ass blue-white in the dark room, smooth and hard and pumping as she cried. The second boy, the dark-haired one, stood at the head of the bed, pinning Pippi's shoulders. I stepped over gaps from missing floorboards into the cabin.
"Stop it," I said.
The second boy lit up when he saw me, perhaps hoping for a chance himself. I brandished the scissors, a dull silver in the dark room.
"She's serious," said the dark-haired boy. He released Pippi's shoulders.
The blonde one slammed himself into Pippi with renewed vigor at the prospect of her backing out. I stepped closer.
"Get off her," I said.
"Let's go," said the dark-haired boy.
The blonde pulled himself off Pippi, grabbed his shorts from the floor, and left with his friend, both avoiding my scissors. Pippi just cried there on the mattress. I untied the bandana from my neck and placed it on the bed. You can use this to clean yourself, I said. I left her and walked outside to make sure the boys were gone. Satisfied they were not coming back, I walked to the stream. I raised the scissors and felt for a handful of my long hair, pulled it taut, and cut. Every muscle relaxed with that release, and I continued, feeling for any stray lock, until my hair was cropped to less than a thumb's length all around. I tossed my hair into the river and watched it travel downstream, sliding over rocks, off into the darkness. I helped Pippi back to our cabin. With much crying, she thanked me for rescuing her and admitted she should have followed my advice. She promised to write once she got home to Cologne. Pippi's parents retrieved her the next day, not at all happy if their abrupt manner was any indication. I watched her leave as she waved through the rear window of her parents' car, my one friend gone. For the rest of my stay, I kept my scissors close, but in the end, my self-cut hair did the trick, and boys let me be. When the sleepaway trip concluded, half of my cabin went home, fingers crossed, hoping to have a baby, while I left camp happily without a fertilized egg.
Chapter 4 Caroline, 1939. Once Hitler invaded Poland, mild foreboding turned to genuine panic at every New York consulate, and all hell broke loose at our office. To make things worse, Washington tightened visa restrictions, and it became almost impossible to enter the United States from Europe. France limited its visas as well. By November, people desperate to be at the head of the line braved the cold and slept the night under the stars in sleeping bags beneath my office window. Once we opened in the morning, the line of French citizens desperate to get home often snaked out from our reception area into the hallway. My bosom friend, Betty Merchant, chose a gray late November day to stop by with her donation. I heard her arrive and issue orders to Pia for hot tea that would never come. Betty forged her way into my office, dressed in an indigo boucle chaparelli suit and a hat adorned with indigo and scarlet feathers, a folded newspaper under one arm. In one hand, she carried an old wedding present from a New Jersey couple, a 3-foot-high money tree made of $60-$100 bills folded into little paper fans on a wooden base. In the other, she balanced a tower of nested shoe boxes. Betty set the money tree on my blotter. I brought this for your French babies. That should buy some tinned milk. It was good to see Betty, but I was behind schedule, and case folders were stacking up. In the French tradition, our office was closed for lunch from 12:30 to 3, and I'd allocated that time to eat canned tuna at my desk and regroup for the afternoon onslaught. Thank you, Betty. Good to see you, but... And shoe boxes, as promised. I only brought the French ones so those babies would feel at home. Betty's shoe habit provided the vessels for the comfort boxes I sent abroad, and I knew there'd be a steady stream to come. Betty closed my office door. I'm closing this on account of Miss Big Ears out there. Pia? She listens to everything, you know. Desperate to know where we're lunching, of course. I'm swamped and not hungry either, I'm afraid. You can't sneak in a bite? There's nothing like a martini to stir up a lazy appetite. How can I take lunch with that crowd waiting? I just had a couple from Lyon who haven't heard from their daughter back in France since June, both sobbing. Honestly, Caroline, you're a volunteer and you can't even take lunch. These people need me. That elevator boy of yours, Cuddy, maybe I'll take him to 21. There's something about a man in uniform. Betty looked in her compact mirror, checking herself for imperfections. Finding none, she shrugged, disappointed. Betty was often compared to Rita Hayworth,
for she was blessed with an abundant head of hair and curves that once caused an elderly fellow in a wheelchair to stand and walk for the first time in years. She wasn't always the prettiest girl in the room, but it was hard to take your eyes off her, like a train accident or a dancing bear. "You need a break, Caroline. Why not be my bridge partner?" "I can't, Betty. Things are crazy here. With Hitler throwing his weight around, half of France is trying to get out, and the other half is desperate to get back in. I have 60 comfort packages to assemble. You're welcome to help." "I do love the French. Seems you do as well. Saw that new boyfriend of yours yesterday on his way to the theater." A few snowflakes fell outside the window. Was it snowing at our house up in Connecticut? "He's not my boyfriend." "Unfortunately, too true. Though I saw Paul often that fall and early winter. He would stop by the consulate before rehearsal, and we'd share a brown bag lunch up on the French building's roof garden, no matter the weather." "You seem to find time for him. Mother told me she saw you step across to Sardi's. Tête-à-tête at lunch with a tall European." "Her words. The whole town is talking about it, see. Seems he's become your best friend now." Betty lobbed a folded newspaper onto my desk. "There's a blurb about you two in the Post. Did you know he was voted world's most handsome man by Physical Culture magazine?" I wasn't surprised, but was somehow flattered by that. Who even voted for those things? "One lunch," I said. "Really? Giving him notes on his show?" Betty leaned across my desk. "You deserve a lover, Caroline, but keep it quiet, darling. Does it have to be a theater person? And one so, well, public? I know you're still smarting from David. If I'd known my brother was..." "That's over, Betty. I can run interference for you, but once a reputation's tarnished, there's no polishing it. Evelyn Shimmerhorn is enormous. Can't leave the house." "Would you leave Evelyn alone? I don't care what people think." "You'll care when you're not called up for get-togethers. Why not let me fix you up? Honestly, David may be my brother, but he has his faults, God knows. You're better off without him. But don't rebound with some Frenchman just to spite him. Every man has a silhouette, you know, of the woman he'll end up with. We just need to find a suitable man with yours in mind." "You must have better things to think about, Betty." Betty had been my biggest supporter since our first day at the then co-ed Chapin, when a boy in French class called me Le Girafon, and she ground the heel of her white kid boot into his foot. "If it were up to me, I'd have you and Paul both stark naked atop the Chrysler building, but I'm trying to protect you, dear." To my great relief, Betty said she had to run. I followed her to the reception area, where she took the money tree and dropped it on Pia's desk. "I hope you don't expect me to deposit this," Pia said, leaning back in her chair, Gauloise in hand. "Won't you be a sight on Fifth Avenue? By the way, do you own a bra, Pia, dear? The word is brassiere." Betty tossed a dollar on Pia's desk. "Take this and buy yourself one. They're cheaper in the children's department." As Betty left the reception room, Paul bounded off the elevator, brown bag in hand, and held the door for her. Betty just gave me her best I-told-you-so look and headed on her way. Paul had come that day to iron out his visa issues with Roger, and I elbowed in on the meeting. I wanted to show my support for Paul, for it would surely convince Roger to help him stay. Roger had installed a Murphy bed in his office, and he'd left it down, with the bed linens balled atop it like used tissues. It had not been productive sleep. "I need to get Rena out of France," Paul said. Roger pulled an electric razor from a drawer and set it on the blotter.
We can try. The U.S. visa is a hot item.